We've all been able to experience the benefits of community and how grassroots efforts translate into connection. And today's guests are here to share their core values, which are benefiting us all. Ben Schnelli rose literally out of the mud to get in sync with nature, saving his livelihood. And Garth Brown's experience at Karen Crest Farm continues to be enhanced by regenerative practices and by questioning the big picture along the way. Thanks for joining us for these regenerative agriculture conversations on Cultivated Audio for January 2025. Ben, it seems like you went from tractors buried in the mud and a devastating loss of livestock, up to hundreds of cattle and many, many calves in blizzards in 2019, directly to a chair at Gabe Brown's Soil Health Academy weekend.
Yeah, it was quite a ride. That was tough.
I bet.
Sometimes, being up against the wall, you have nowhere else to go but one way, one direction. It's up. That's the only choice you have.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Gabe reached back out to me. I mean, that's the start of the story, really, is I reached out to Gabe, and he actually reached back out to me.
From what I'm learning more and more about the regenerative agriculture community, folks are really willing to share what they know and to reach out and lend a helping hand.
To an extent, I think part of it is those of us that were in agriculture, conventional agriculture, we found this through adversity. So with adversity, you have a different mindset and your paradigms shift. You have no choice. You cannot think conventionally anymore. You can't throw enough money at some situations to fix them. So, you know, through that adversity, there's a humbling process. In that humbling process, people are more willing to help others. That's what I found. 2019, that winter was the perfect storm. It went from a thunderstorm to a blizzard to a fast thaw. It just turned into an almost instant disaster that wouldn't quit. You know, you got the LA wildfires now. You got the hurricane in North Carolina. It was that intense and it was that sudden. And when you're in a conventional mindset, you do things a certain way. That's just the way you do it. So when that blizzard hit us, we had cows out on stocks, which was normal. Okay, we got to start getting cows home. We couldn't get to them. We finally get them home thinking we'll get through this. And then it flips on us and turns to mud. Well, you got too many cows in the lots, a conventional mindset again, and then you got cows getting buried, and it wouldn't quit. So then you get to a calving scenario that you can't work your way out of. I mean, you're dragging calves in the barn, your tractors are stuck, you got excavators pulling out tractors because tractors can't even pull out tractors. And then that time, you switch to survival mode. What can I do? So we're hauling cows to grass in March. The ones that are live with calves, you think, okay, we're okay. We can't get feed enough to them, but at least they're on pasture, so they're on footing. Well, you get another blizzard. One night, 30-some calves are dead. And those are the ones that made it from home.
Hmm.
Okay, this ain't working. All right, see, you're constantly looking for answers, and you're not finding them in a conventional model. Plus, we're broke. I mean, you couldn't throw money at it.
Right.
You know, the bank had enough of us. And so, yeah. So you couldn't throw enough money at it to change your problem. You had to look different ways. In that spring is when we found out about Gabe. He reached out to us. You fast forward to the summer to go to that school down in Holton. Well, I asked a lot of stupid questions, but I had to change what I was doing.
And you found out quickly, I'm sure, that they weren't stupid questions at all.
No. But you feel like a bug because these other people you think have all the answers and you just don't know nothing. And nobody made fun of me. And they just would constantly say, well, what about this? What about this? And they just constantly were building on a scenario to get you out of a problem without spending a ton of money. He was actually saying, quit that. I know Gabe on a different level than most people do, and he just tells me like it is. Why'd you do that? What's why I'm supposed to do it? That don't work.
Right.
He would constantly be pointing in a direction of growth, and it wasn't always what I wanted to hear.
Hmm.
I had such a respect for him that if he said it, I did it. And then I would understand the why, and it's just been a process. It went from a disaster, okay, today. It took me 4 hours to get one of the tractors to start. I'm still not there.
There is no there.
No.
No matter what you're doing, there's no there.
That's exactly right. You always want to be in a place of growth.
Right, yes. So tell us about your operation as far as how much acreage you have, how many livestock you have, and what's the land like in rainfall, et cetera. Where are you?
We're on the fourth year of a drought. So, you know, normally we'll get 20 inches of rain, but we're on our fourth year of drought. And I've learned a lot through that, you know, so normally we're 20, 25 inches of rain a year. We're native grass. You know, our carrying capacity can be 4 acres to 7 acres per cow, calf. Right now, it's quite a bit less because of the drought. We're in an interesting place. They call it the tall grass prairie in southeast Nebraska. It's not the sand hills. It's not the flint hills of Kansas. We're right in the middle, and it's kind of a unique ecosystem where we are. Where we have more forbs and more legumes. There's more diversity, and it's called the tall grass prairie. On a good year, we can have 6 foot native grass.
Mm.
We really can. Well, we haven't had that for quite a while. So that would give you a kind of a backdrop of our location. And we run, well, our cow herd varies. You know, it can be around 300 cows. Right now is not a time of growth because of our drought. So, you know, we maybe run a few less than that now. We have some bees. We have some chickens. We do have horses. So we're trying to run a regenerative niche, but there's not a lot of reception to that in our area. Hmm. We're not in an area that really accepts it. So as far as selling our honey, we sell a little bit. I was just talking to my brother about selling eggs. People don't want to buy eggs because they can buy them cheaper at the grocery store. We've planted some fruit trees. We do have beef to sell. We're trying different aspects in our operation to diversify, as Gabe Brown talks about stacking enterprises. Well, that's something we're trying to do, and we're getting started in it. My goal is so my kids can take over the operation and have a living there and not have to leave, that they can stay on the land.
Well, that's certainly worthwhile, and your children will appreciate it more and more the older they get, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're hardworking. They're good kids.
No doubt. Well, Ben, remembering back to that first weekend, taking in all this new information, and you just mentioned that the area where you live is not necessarily that open to what's going on with regen. Where was your mindset? I know you've mentioned that you were open, and if Gabe said something, you were in. But were there initial objections in your own head that you had to get over while you were sitting there? Maybe there was one thing you thought, oh, this will never work, or I can't do that. And then you did see your way around it, and you could do it.
Well, that's a tough question. I remember one comment I had, well, that won't work here. And Gabe laughed. He says, you know, I've been all over the world, and I hear that story, that statement, every single place I go. I can't tell you even the scenario. I'm sorry, I can't remember it.
That's okay.
But the fact was, Gabe could tie it, and he says, it's all the same principles. That's the one thing that really helped me get over some of the limitations to the ideas that, boy, I don't, how's that going to work? You know, that mindset of doubt.
Yes.
Well, I would take that and Gabe would explain the principles and the concepts. He says, it works everywhere. This is the principle. Now you adapt it. You know, Gabe calls it adaptive grazing for a reason. So last year with the drought, we're moving the cows fast from paddock to paddock because we didn't have grass. And I don't like to bother Gabe. It drives him nuts. He says, why don't you call me more? Well, I don't like bothering you. So towards the end of the year, we're talking, and I says, Gabe, my grass could never keep up. He says, well, how quick did you move them? Well, every day they didn't have enough grass. He says, that's your problem. He says, Ben, it's adaptive grazing for a reason. In the drought, you slow them down, and you don't look backwards. You look forward to that paddock clear on the other side of the pasture. You give it a little more rest. So those principles Gabe instilled in me from the very first conference, it was hard to grasp. Was there doubt? Yes. But there was always answers from the team that made sense. You could relate to them. They were logical, and you could see your way through them. I can't even tell you what we were talking about. It could have been about feeding, because that was a big part of my questioning, was how to feed cows and do things, and because that was what I was coming out of a disaster with. Mm-hmm. So that aspect really changed me, because they always would give you a logical, understandable explanation that didn't cost a lot of money. It just took some effort. Right. Well, I could do that. I'm good at working. Money was not there. So that would probably be my best way to say that. And I hope that would encourage somebody that's listening. This is something that I say. When you see a wall, look for a crack. You're going to see plenty of walls in regenerative ag. It's going to seem daunting. It's going to seem lonely. People aren't going to like you. Look for a crack. Look for something that will work.
How did you settle on what to do first when you got back home? What's the first thing that you did? What did you work on?
Well, I'm all in or I'm all out. That's my personality. My personality is not to test the waters. I will take the information in. If it's going to work, I'm going to do it. And I did it all. One of the things we were doing was feeding distiller's grain. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a byproduct of the ethanol process. Everybody feeds cattle distiller's grain. Why? Well, that's what we're told to do. Well, that's the first thing I did. Quit that. That was about a $30,000 bill I got rid of. The other thing we quit doing, we quit vaccinating our cows. We quit pouring our cows. Well, we quit everything. We were already doing rotational grazing, and we were in the process of putting in more cross fences and more tanks on our pasture. The NRCS had them paddocks all messed up because they sit at a computer and they draw it out how they want it. And I said, this will never work. We completely redid it. That was the most important thing I did, was go to that school so I could see grazing patterns and how to think. We completely redid it, and it's working good. Gabe told me this. He warned me. He says, your cows are not going to do good this year. I says, I can't take any more loss. He looked at me and shrugged his shoulders and says, they have to change too. The first year was tough. We didn't lose many cows, but it was tough. They looked terrible. Let's fast forward to today. Our cows get no mineral, no lick tubs, no distillers. They're on corn stalks. We'll feed them here in the spring before calving. We'll calve them on grass, and our cows look okay. Are they fat? No, they're not fat, but they look okay. They handle it well. Our calves don't get sick like they used to. When we vaccinate them, we'd vaccinate calves, and the next 2 weeks we'd be treating calves because they were sick. And I was like, this is ridiculous. You'd say it to the vet, well, you got to vaccinate with this too.
Right.
And they get sicker.
Yeah.
We quit.
I just want to mention real quickly that I've been into the raw milk movement for quite some time. And in learning about it, I learned that a lot of the dairy farmers back east, back in the day before there was any legislation for pasteurization, the cow farmers thought, oh, we can feed them the slop from the beer, you know, from the hops. And when they started using that as feed, that's when the cows started getting sick. That's when the milk went off. And I don't mean sour, but when it wasn't good, healthy stuff that it used to be. And then that's when the legislation all got started. So hearing you talk about you're not feeding them the distilled anymore, it makes so much sense to me.
You know, it's sad, and we could go off on a ton of rabbit trails with this, but what big business has done to all of us, the distillers' grains, the ethanol plants, need to get rid of them.
Right.
So what better way to do it than to promote the feedlots and the cow-calf guys to buy distillers, because your cows need it. Negative effects of distillers is the sulfur in the distillers can get out of balance, and you get what you call brainers. They don't go crazy, but they fall over, and they can't get up. You can stand them up, and they fall over. Stand them up, and they fall over. You have to feed a byproduct mineral to counter that, and you can still lose them. Every year, cattle die because of distillers, but the feed companies still promote them. Well, you got to feed distillers. It's worth it. No, it's not. And our local butcher, he says people that feed high levels of distillers, when he butchers them cattle, you know, it's not fast, it's slow. He says you can smell the sulfur in their meat.
Oh,
it's not a good product. Your omegas are out of whack. Everything that is supposed to be in balance is gone. You know, how can we get healthy as a people when we're poisoning what we're doing?
Boy, and it's rampant. Thank you so much for bringing this up. This is such an important point about the feed, for sure. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, Gabe says, well, you need to do grass-finished beef. I said, I can't do grass-finished beef. We're not set up for that. And he says, he looks at me and kind of, he has this funny smile. And he kind of gives me that look, and I'm thinking, oh, crap, here we go. And you know what? We're really not set up yet for it, but I did a couple of them. Boy, was that good meat. Okay, so Gabe says adaptive, does he not? So I can't do everything perfect. None of us are on that perfection plane yet. But I can do little things. So we'll send steers to grass or heifers that we want to eat. And if I can butcher them in the fall when they're off grass and they have some condition on them, that's perfect. But you know what? If I can't, I give them some rolled corn and I give them some hay. And it's as close as I can get. And the meat is very, there's not a lot of difference.
Right.
So, okay, that's an adaptive part of regenerative agriculture. We're moving in a direction for people to be healthy and to still do right. I'm not reinventing the wheel. But I say this so people that are listening are not discouraged because they can't do it perfect. You're never going to do it perfect. Do the best you can with what you got.
Absolutely, yes. So, Ben, what was your focus and what did you do with the land? What was the first thing you either looked at or moved into?
I suppose the best way to answer this is the most what we have is pasture. The first step is how you're going to graze it, because the animal has to do your change. The animals you're changing instrument. So our grazing patterns had to change. That I knew I could do instantly. Okay, I did that. And I'm still working on that. I see things and I'll move things, and it's a process. The second thing was, we knew we couldn't calve in the lots anymore. Okay, so we calve at the pasture. I drive 40 miles every day calving cows. You know, we have a set of cows by our house, and we have the big set of cows at the pasture. That grass sits idle all year. And most of our pastures is what you call go-back ground. Back in the 30s, 20s and 30s, it was broke. Well, wheat was worth a fortune then, and everybody was tearing everything up. So most of our pasture actually was farmed at one time. So our topsoil and our soil is actually depleted. So in doing what I'm doing, rest, impact, rest, you know, moving things, I can show you in the pasture where I have microbiology. It's like a snake in the ground. It's that distinct. This year it's dry, so that grass is only 3-4 feet tall, and right beside it, it might be 2 inches tall. So that impact is changing our biology, You know, we have a little bit of farm ground down there. Now, the sad thing is we still have to put up feed. So I'm very disappointed in the process of moving my soil forward, but I am moving it because I have to put up feed still in the droughts, and I don't have a large enough land base there. I'm not resting it as much, and I'm using cover crops, but I'm having to put most of it up for feed because of the drought. So if you understand that adaptive, well, I'm not there yet, but I've went a long ways because you pull that soil out of the ground, you smell it, and I don't know how to explain it. You just kind of know.
Yes.
It's just different. And then you pull them roots out, and you see that cottage cheese effect of aggregate. And you know you're moving forward, but I'll be honest with you, it feels like it's at a below a snail's pace. Mm. But those are probably the three things we do. We still have to put up feed. You know, we don't have a land base that we can just graze. We have a set of cows here at home right now. We ran out of corn stalks for them. Well, it's a good thing it's really cold. But generally, the cow herd gets fed from March to the first part of May. We've tightened our window of feeding to that point. We don't feed a lot. That's where we're at still. We don't have the land base to have them March, April cover crops to bridge that gap. That's our time we're still working on. Will I get there? It's going to take a pretty good land base to get to there. But that's my goal. First thing I did, okay, I changed my grazing patterns. That's first thing. Second thing I did, I got a calf at the pasture. Did that. Third thing, we're leaving pieces idle. We're impacting them. You know, you think about that. You put them cows in a paddock, say it's 50, 60 acres, and you feed them in there. Well, what are you doing? You're moving nutrients. And then them cattle impact and stimulate that biology to grow in the ground. You're leaving them nutrients, and then you get them out of there, and you let it rest.
Right.
That's where I'm the most excited about, mm-hmm. where I'm the most critical about myself, honestly, is where my cover crop, my cover to the soil is. I'm okay, but my little girl, well, she's not little anymore. She says, you know, Gabe would scold you. I said, yeah, I know, honey. So the kids get
Uh-oh.
It.
Uh-oh. Oh, when the kids start knowing something and they're telling us about it, that's a tough one.
Well, you know what, though? It makes me proud.
Of course, yes.
You know, you're thinking, of well, course. They do pay attention once in a while.
Right. Oh, that's very sweet. I love hearing that. That's great. What is her name?
Well, that's Claire.
Claire.
Claire's the one that does that.
All right. Well, tell her good going. Keep her eye on you.
Oh, they do. As they get older, I get dumber. I'm waiting for the day when I get smarter again.
Okay. Well, yeah, let me know how that works.
Uh-huh.
So was there one thing where one day you just kind of woke up and said, oh, my gosh, this is amazing? Like, or were you out in your field or with a certain cow at one point and you just really got struck with, yep, this is it. This is working.
Well, there's probably a couple things. Well, there's lots, but a couple stories will come to mind. So we were in an equip contract with putting them tanks in. And let me just say this. The government says they're in favor of regenerative agriculture, but they hate it. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't fit their mold. They want to check a box. So one of the things I was required to do was spray brush, which isn't that was in the contract. I sprayed it all. All I did was give it a headache. You know, it kind of burnt back, and it never died. And I spent a lot of time and money doing this. All right. Well, then all this happens with Gabe. And I tell the NRCS, it don't work. We have to do something different. So I shredded a piece, and I showed him that fall. And I showed Gabe. It was the year I met Gabe. So I showed him. He says, yeah, that works. So we did this. We shredded it back, got it short. It grass came through, really looked nice. I says, you know, now we could spray it if you want, or we can see how this works. Well, you got to spray it. This does not qualify for our program, so you have to let it grow and spray it. I shook my head. I let that be this last spring. I started shredding all that again, and it's just amazing what happened in a drought. That grass came through. Now that brush started to grow again. now we know woody plants take a long time to break down. You know, the carbon to nitrogen ratio is way up there.
Right.
It's a slow breakdown, but it's still possible. So I shredded all that, and it was a disaster. I took the gearbox out of the shredder twice, and I broke all kinds of stuff. But the difference I made made a difference. So the government, they kicked us out of the program. But it works. And they knew it works, but they said, we cannot measure this and justify it. Okay. So that worked. Now, will I have to shred it, spray it? Yes, I'm going to have to. But see, this is what I learned through this process. Do we like chemicals? No. Gabe Brown makes an important point about that, too. He says the soil can take acute, it's just like you and I. We can take a cut, and our body will heal quick. You know, it's acute, it's done, it's over. The soil can take acute things as well, but it can't handle when we just do it year after year after year. So by my experiment, I've killed half of that brush just by shredding it. So guess what? I've made it vulnerable, so I can spray it once, kill 90% of it, and then shred it again in 5 years, what's left, and I'll probably win. Because, see, I have wild strawberries out there. I have blackberries. I don't want to kill them.
Right.
In that moment, I learned something. I did that this spring. I talked to somebody else, and they says, you just need to try it. It's real vulnerable. Grass don't grow. You need to try it. All right. So I went with Impact. I moved my feed bunks the 1st of May to this paddock, moved all the cows in there, fed them for 2 weeks, and got them out of there. In the 10 years we've had the pasture, we've never had grass grow in that piece. It's just short. It's really highly abused, eroded soil. So I did it. I thought, well, this will ought to be good. You know what? It was a drought again this year, and that's the best grass we've ever had.
Sometimes
you have to be brave.
Yes. Well,
sometimes you're a hero, and sometimes you're a zero. But sometimes you just got to try.
Yeah.
But it works.
Well, that's wonderful. Is there a favorite part of your day over there on your land?
You know, we move cows most of the time every day, but, you know, we will get towards two or three times every 2 or 3 days. And Gabe's got me talked into, he had me do it in one big group. Well, that's really tough because you might miss a calf or something, and that don't work so good. So we run them in two groups now. And, you know, what's real enjoyable for me is we have a good set of cows. We really do. And we spend time with them.
Nice.
When you go to move them cows and they see you coming over the hill, because we use the ranger because we don't use the horses to move them because they'll just follow you. They'll see us. They'll start gathering up, and you'll call them. You'll go to the gate. You just get out of the way. They'll just walk through to the next piece. And it's just a peaceful, enjoyable time. You know, to some people, they would relate this to a pet. I don't. But you still have that connection to production agriculture that has been so disconnected anymore. You know, we still have a job to do. Our job is to nurture the animals, feed them, take care of them so they can feed and take care of us. But you still have that intimate connection. We have cows that are named. We have pets. The kids know most of the cows anyway. It's just so rewarding. You kind of have that shepherd feeling where, okay, they're coming. Here they come. You call them. You stand out of the way. They go into their paddock. They go spread out, and they go graze. They walk. The calves all go straight to the tank and get a drink. The cows aren't there to boss them around. It's just fun. I just enjoy it.
Nice.
I thoroughly enjoy it.
It is. Well, Ben, do you have a favorite steak?
Boy, that's a good question. They're all good. The other night, we had some really, really good ribeyes.
All right.
Boy, I like them all. That's the other neat thing about regenerative ag. The flavor. The flavor of the meat is so much different. You know, if you feed them right, it just tastes good. I'm sure you know this. We've always been taught they have to be so fat. The marbling. Oh, that's a bunch of hooey. That's just so the packers can get away with more and they have more trim to do other stuff with. We don't necessarily need fat. We need to do things different.
Well, cool. Well, is there anything you'd like to share as a final comment before we close?
Wow. Well, thanks for the opportunity. And I guess the best thing I can say is don't give up. Regenerative ag is hard. Everybody has knowledge. Wisdom generally comes from the application of knowledge. And sometimes that comes the hard way. But always look for people that have done it the hard way and try and adapt to your surroundings to change your way of life to make an impact on others. You know, one thing, Gabe, I asked him when I did that article with him, I did not want to do that. You're kind of hanging yourself out there long ways. So I asked Gabe one question. I says, do people need this? And I says, will it help others? That's what it's about.
Yep. Yeah.
If we can do those two things, a lot will change.
Garth, tell us about Karen Crest Farm, where you are, the geography, rainfall, livestock, etc., and how long have you been farming and ranching?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on. We bought Karen Crest Farm, it's me, my wife, my brother, and my sister-in-law, in 2010, but we really started it as a functional farm business in about 2015. That's when we started bringing animals on and started trying to market to customers instead of just raising things for ourselves. We are located right in the middle of New York State, near Cooperstown, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is. That's one landmark some people know.
Yes.
If you don't know where that is, just look at a map of New York State and put your finger in the very geographical middle of it, and that's basically where we are. Now, you asked what we raise. We raise on the farm grass-fed, grass-finished beef and lamb, and we also raise pastured pork. And then we sell chicken raised by a good friend in Canajoharie, which is about 40 minutes away from us.
And what kind of rainfall do you guys get?
It's a pretty rainy area. I won't throw out a number, but it's the standard New England rain. We occasionally will have a drought, but we really aren't generally limited by water. Growth isn't limited by water. It's limited by temperature and seasonality.
Sure. When you hear the word efficiency in regards to your farm, what first comes to mind?
Efficiency is something I spend quite a lot of time thinking about. When I first got into farming, I was very idealistic. And I'd say I remain idealistic to an extent, but I've also maybe become more realistic. And there are real challenges that farms the scale of mine have with production. And you can look at that two ways. You can look at that in terms of animals or calories produced per acre, and then also in terms of human labor. And the reason we have the industrial food system we do, in my mind, comes down mostly to its incredible efficiency, just the raw ability to produce a lot of calories for very little money and very little human labor. So when we talk about the trade-offs between moving from an industrial ag system towards one that incorporates smaller, diverse, pasture-based farms, we need to be realistic about the very real economic challenges. Like, I'm never going to be able to sell beef as cheap as feedlot beef from Texas. Depending on how you do the math, I probably will never be able to raise beef with as small a land print as feedlot beef from Texas. So I don't want to go on too long, but I just think that advocates for reforming the farming system, which I very much consider myself a part of, should think long and hard about how we are going to keep food relatively affordable, how we are going to actually incentivize smaller farms. For example, meat becomes a luxury good that only the affluent can afford.
Yes, it certainly seems that way, doesn't it? And even the other meat is becoming expensive for a lot of the population.
Yes, not cheap.
Yes. So what comes to mind when you're working with that efficiency in mind? And you are in a regen system, you're working with the land. And to me, that's where the real efficiency lies, in that natural system. But what stands out for you in your daily working on the farm ranch that you do?
Well, I think
what challenges you?
The one thing that both established farmers who farm in the diversified way that I do, and also people who are thinking about getting into it, should recognize is that some degree of specialization isn't a bad thing. Like, we went through a phase where we had our own cow herd, and we were farrowing our own pigs, and we were lambing our own sheep, and we were raising turkeys. And it's very hard to manage that many enterprises at a small scale and to do a really good job. So now we have found a wonderful farmer who shares our values and practices, and he wants to be a cow-calf operator. So he raises fantastic grass-fed cows with the genetics we like, and we buy weaned calves from him, and then we raise them out through finish. We found a good pork farmer who raises piglets with good genetics that have some marbling and are old-fashioned enough to be happy on pasture, and we no longer farrow our own pigs. We buy poultry, as I said, from a good friend who shares our values. And I think if you look historically, there's always been some of that. People find a strength and follow that path and then work together to make a network that's diversified. So I think really being very prudent about the specific enterprises we have on our farm and then the form of those and complexity of those enterprises allows us to be more efficient than if we tried to literally be a self-sufficient farm where everything was closed and we were an entirely closed system that wasn't reliant on anyone else.
Yes.
So I think in that word, you know, we all want to be diversified small farms, but exactly what a diversified farm means can be quite different, and the amount of efficiency in various systems is pretty variable. So I guess I would advocate for trying to have a diversified farm community more than having every farm be its own hyper-diversified entity. Like, try to think of it more as a collective agricultural ecosystem that is hopefully still local and still hopefully small, but that doesn't require every individual to do everything for themselves. And I think that's a shift in thought that would be really beneficial for those of us trying to build a really viable alternative to industrial agriculture.
Yes, it certainly is. And it certainly goes along with what the whole regenerative agricultural system is, right? If your soil isn't producing, and if your plants aren't producing, and the cattle, everything does work together. And I've always kind of marveled at how the community is the default system. When the big corporations start falling apart, what do? We look to our neighbor. We look for the local community. That's going to be what really does get us through everything. And I love how you've been able to do that on Karen Crest Farm. Before this interview, you had mentioned making tangible connections between the public and their food source. Now, you just mentioned all of the community that you've got going, partnering up with different people. What other steps have you taken at Karen Crest Farm to bring this about with the public? And were there any ideas that you tried that just didn't work?
Well, I really am very interested in the sort of all aspects of agriculture and farming. So one thing I do is I write a blog weekly. You know, some blogs are just publicity, like this is how great our farm is. I try to take a broader view of this is what's going on in the ag world that's interesting. This is something you might not know about. Here's a trend. Here's a big multinational meat packer that is opening stores in your neighborhood, you know, things like that. So I try to be very educational and public facing and write in a way that anyone can come upon one of the posts I write and go away having learned something, no matter how much background knowledge they come in with. So I really try to write thinking of the general public first, not other farmers first, for the most part.
Yes, that's great.
As far as something that we tried that didn't work, one thing that I feel sort of sad about is when we started, first we did farmers markets, then we did buyers clubs where people would place an order and then I would drive down with those orders on a set date, meet up with people at specified times and locations. It's called a buyers club model. Joel Salatin famously sort of pioneered it. A lot of other farms have used it. And I really liked that because it put a face to each customer who was buying our meat. It let me, you know, make that human connection. If they had any questions about who we are or what we do, people were always surprised. Oh, you're actually the farmer. You're not an employee.
Right.
You actually were out there with the animals. And the reason I said that was a failure is we have, in the past 5 years, moved away from that model and moved into one where we ship all of our orders to our customers, which I have mixed feelings about. It seems to be what people want. If given the choice, basically everybody chose to just have their order shipped to them rather than go through the hassle of maybe buying 3 weeks out and then having to set aside time on Saturday to go meet me at some random place at 10:15. So I understand why people prefer having orders shipped to them, but I still feel a little bit sad about not having that one-on-one human connection, even though it has undeniably made my life better in a lot of ways.
I'm
sure. Of course, having weekends with my family and all those things. I think the broader question of how do we get people who are living busy lives and have a lot of things competing for attention to make the connection between the food choices they make and the broader health of agricultural communities, their bodies, their communities. And that's honestly something I don't really feel like I have a good answer to. You know, I can write and I can invite people to come visit my farm. Not very many do just because it's far away and who has time to, you know, drive out and look at cows. So it's something I think about and I don't have a great answer to, but I do think it's, again, another aspect for those of us who really want to change the food system. I don't have a lot of faith that legislation is going to do it. I think it mostly is going to be about drawing that connection for people, the people who are eating the food we produce, with the land and with ourselves and our communities.
Yes, and the education is a big piece of that. And it's so nice to see that you're doing that. You're letting people know, well, why do I want to go and wait for my meat to come in the mail? Because it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile for your health. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line. So it's so great to see that. And, you know, if you're talking about legislation and government, well, we always have to default to ourselves and our neighbors and our teams. It's just like the whole medical system, because you can't just go to a doctor and say, okay, fix me and you're in charge of me. It just doesn't work like that. It never has, and I don't think it ever will. It's kind of funny, you know, you're talking about all these things you do, and it's like, well, it really did free up time for you not to go meet these people, although you probably enjoyed every minute of it. And it's a whole other aspect, isn't it, that this regen is bringing on for the farmer. When you talk about people like Gabe Brown or Joel Salatin, I mean, they're rock stars. When I interviewed Joel Salatin, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago for the first time, he was not really anybody that anybody knew. And then 8 years ago, we have a wonderful Chautauqua Auditorium here in Boulder, and he's just a farmer, and he was coming to tell people the story, and he sold out the auditorium, and regular citizens, not farmers, but people that are interested, and came out to see him. And I just thought, this is an amazing shift. But the truth is, it's a slow rollout. It's a disservice, certainly, to present regenerative agriculture as an easy ride, but farming's never been an easy ride. And I'm wondering what you're thinking with people that you speak with. Do you think it's a mindset that, well, this is the way we've always done it? Or do you think it's fear of change that's creating this slow roll?
You mean as far as getting farmers to shift from more conventional approaches to more regenerative approaches?
Yes.
I think that there are two answers to that question. When it comes to broad adoption, I'm somewhat optimistic that in a lot of places, certain practices like reduced tillage to no tillage and cover cropping to build organic matter, I think in a lot of places, the simple economics of those will be persuasive. Like if those are showed to make crops yield better in low rainfall years, to reduce fertilizer requirements for a similar yield, then I think the simple logic of the market will cause them to spread.
Right.
And I'm not a crop farmer, but from my reading about it, I'm hopeful that that will be the case as more research dollars go into those. What I am less certain of is the broader mindset shift. And that sort of takes me back to where I started. Like, I think it's very likely regenerative practices will spread to the extent that they prove profitable. What it will take to make, say, average farm size get a little bit smaller, to make it so that young people who want to get into farms can do so rather than have the continuing corporatization of farms and corporate ownership of farmland. Those are the things that I have a harder time seeing how to bring about, just because the structural forces that have led to the consolidation we've seen up till now continue to be in place. Like, I don't see what is going to undo the logic of industrial agriculture. So let me give you an example. Where I am, it is historic dairy country. There were a lot of small dairy farms here, and there was sort of a golden period from roughly 1950 to the early 80s when you could have a family dairy farm and make a good middle-class living being a dairy farmer. And a lot of my old neighbors when I first moved here were retired dairy farmers, and they painted, I'm sure, at times sort of nostalgically tinged view of it, but it really was the case that it was a community and that they helped each other and that they were all making common cause in this enterprise of family dairying. New York now makes more milk than it ever has, but there is a 3,000 cow dairy about 20 minutes away, and there are no dairy farms in my valley that still milk. So that logic of consolidation seems pretty inexorable, and to really have a system where people are connected to the land through their food, I just don't think that's compatible with 3,000 cow dairies and 60,000 cow feedlots and a global food system. So I'm hopeful that some regenerative practices are on the march, but I'm less certain that any sort of systemic change of the agricultural system is going to follow from that.
Yes. In some reading I've been doing, I wanted to look at, well, how has it changed? I started this podcast in 2020, and it's now starting out 2025, obviously. And I was curious, well, what has changed in the regen ag direction? And there are some big corporations like General Mills, PepsiCo, and Starbucks. I mean, they're giving just the littlest bit toward that. So I think, or I'm hoping maybe, but I do think, as you mentioned before, there is profitability. You see the profitability once you do take care of the soil, and oh, wow, we can get a better price for things because it's a better product. And so I'm hoping that that will continue as a trend. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting journey, and I really thank you for not only walking your talk here, but you're really looking and imagining and visioning.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite part of the day on the farm? What's your favorite chore or piece of it?
No, I like sheep. Sheep are my favorite livestock, so I like seeing them and going out. In the growing season, it's definitely moving the animals, you know, portable fencing, watching them all get excited to go into the new fresh grass that never gets old.
Yeah, that's very sweet. What's your favorite steak?
My favorite steak? I like a chuck eye steak.
Uh-huh.
It's not quite as tender as a strip, but it's got, you know, about as much flavor as any cut, and I really, really enjoy one of those.
And so do you have any last comments to conclude our talk today, or any direction that you want to comment on that perhaps we didn't get to?
Well, I guess I would say, a little earlier I mentioned that I am less idealistic, or maybe more tempered in my idealism than I used to be. And I don't view that as a negative. I think I've gotten more curious and more interested as I've become less certain that I have the answers to food and farming and health and all those things. So I guess I would just encourage, whether it's farmers listening or consumers listening, to just be really curious about food and farming and where it comes from, and to look at questions with an open mind, even if you think you know the answer. Like, be open to changing your mind, be open to new possibilities. And that could mean regenerative farmer asking hard questions about the scalability of their model. And it could mean a industrial farmer looking hard about the evidence for practices that improve soil health or human health. So I think approaching agriculture and food with an open mind and a spirit of inquisitiveness is the fundamental thing to actually improving things on the ground.
Yeah, I loved how you just said some people would look at something where they're losing a little bit of faith or wondering how this can really happen, and they would just get depressed. And look what you've done. I'm very impressed. You know, and in reading some of your blogs, well, I read all of them, but in reading some of them, I'm glad that this discussion didn't get into the horrors of, well, look what you people are eating with all of this processed food and everything. And I, because this audience in particular, I think they know that. We don't need reminding,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Singing to the choir. Well, cool. Well, Gar, thank you so much for your time today. And boy, it just sounds like you're on a lifelong vision quest that we all in this worldwide community can certainly benefit from. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Many thanks to Ben Schnelli and to Garth Brown. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts can be found at your favorite podcast platform. I was reminded, perusing the Cairncrest Farm website, of this quote from Wendell Berry that I'd like to share with you. Eating is an agricultural act. Everything you eat contributes in a small way to how animals are treated, how land is used, how clean the air is, and a whole ever-expanding web of connections reaching outward. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.